Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Michael Alenzel and photographers Jeff Louvier and Vanessa Brown about their new book, The Oblivion Atlas. We'll also hear from Marty Muley about his new book, Game Changers, The Rousing Legacy of Louisiana Sports. My guests today are collaborators on a very unusual, mysterious, and lovely book called The Oblivion Atlas. It includes photographic work from the team of Louvier and Vanessa, that's Jeff Louvier and Vanessa Brown, and writing by Michael Alenzel. Jeff Louvier and Vanessa Brown have been working together for more than 10 years and have had exhibitions at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and their work is part of the permanent collection of the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston. Michael Alenzel is the author of the novel Errata, published last year, and the play What Do You Say to a Shadow, produced earlier this year. In his other life, he manages Crescent City Books. Welcome to The Reading Life. Welcome back, Michael.
Thank you.
And welcome, Jeff and Vanessa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Michael, this started with you, this project.
It did. I had been watching a lot of films with long takes. I was really interested in the idea that you could have essentially a photograph with slight gradations in movement. And I wanted to try to develop a writing style that was similar in some fashion. And when I was starting out with that, I thought it would be really wonderful, actually, to collaborate and not have just the stories, since essentially these were almost photographs, I guess, in print and photographs in film.
They are. They're really lovely. So how did you get involved, Jeff?
We got an email out of the blue from Michael.
So you didn't know each other before?
No. We thought maybe he was a stalker. But no, we didn't. We're represented by a gallery for fine photography, and he's almost right across the street. And he had sent an email to us talking about he had been through the gallery several times throughout the years, looking at our different shows, and always wanted to collaborate. And he had this new idea on this sort of movement in his storytelling, and he thought maybe we would be into doing that. And we were. It sounded like a great little project.
So Vanessa, what did you think when you read Michael's stories first?
Well, when we first got the email, he had included three of the stories that he had written. And so I remember reading them and thinking that it wasn't just word-based. You could actually see images in his writing. And so I thought, well, you know, this is going to be a very interesting project to work on with him. So we got together and met and drank red wine and talked about what we were going to do and became very good friends in the interim and then just started working on the project. So
Michael, explain the title.
You know, Jeff actually came up with the title. The idea of this, as far as the Atlas part of it, because there's only one map in this. So this is more of a mapping of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess the stories came about in part by being influenced and having their work infused in the stories. So when they had the Ogden show, which was great, I could go there and watch the films, I could look through, and just whatever element, whether it was a title or something image-wise, then I could work that into the story. So this ended up being a cyclical collaboration. But I think what I guess is also interesting is the epigraph, and this was the third part of the making of it, was these two lines by Jacques Prévert, first paint a cage with an open door. And it ended up, and this was what was fun with the collaboration, the way then that they worked, the visual component of this was not only birds and cages and things like that, but also the idea of the skull and the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, when I see some of this in some of the images, it's the idea that the skull is sort of this bony cage for the mind being the bird, and sometimes those ideas escape.
Oh, right. I love the birds and the feathers and the wings. It's motion, too, frozen right. In that beautiful right. way. Now, you two, Jeff and Vanessa, are in this other book that's come out this month called Inventing Reality, about New Orleans photography. Your work seems all of a piece with the sorts of things that Michael's trying to write about. And your process is very interesting as well. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that, because your photographs are magical and otherworldly.
Well, thank you. Process does play a huge role in how we work. And it is always, gosh, I'm going to have to say, like a marriage between content and process. And so it's always in service of whatever we're taking pictures of. Mm-hmm. We had done some stuff in the past with taxidermy mannequins and sort of this Native American-ish kind of traditional imagery that we printed on handmade sort of flesh-colored paper and toned it with wax and blood as a way of, you know, giving it life in this like really obvious sort of way. The stuff we're doing now with the show of the actual photographs at a gallery is an old process that we sort of reinvented where we are using gold leaf and printing out the images on this really thin Japanese paper. And then we pour resin over the whole thing. And so the resin actually soaks through the paper and sort of all the white areas of the paper disappear, become clear. And so the gold leaf comes through. And so you wind up getting this 21st century version way, I guess, of some of the old orotones where they would take images on glass and paint the back with this banana oil and gold dust. So it was a new way of just sort of reinventing that.
So much depth and texture and mystery. That's really what it is.
It is. It's magical.
So did you have any experiences of, you know, synchronicity as you were working on this project where this something seemed to match perfectly that you weren't expecting?
I guess, you know, with the stories, yeah. Reading the stories, you know, Jeff and I, the way we come up with our ideas, being married, we talk to each other, would have conversations with Michael, and we would both sit down after reading a story and just write down thoughts in our heads. And then come together and try and figure out how we want to illustrate. Mm-hmm. And that was what was nice about the project was being free to illustrate. You know, the fact, like Michael said, he wrote the stuff based on our work and then gave us free rein to go back and re-illustrate his stories as opposed to just illustrate something specific from the book.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, there are a lot of things that I associate with you in these stories. There's the bookstore here, of course. There's the League of Odd Volumes. One of the characters is a librarian. It's literary in the most lovely possible way. So we're very much in the world of books.
Right, very much.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about that centerpiece, that incredible illustration of the man at the piano with the dog.
That one was just a totally fun piece to do in the concept of it. It wasn't trying to be high-minded in any kind of way. We were at Michael and Rebecca's house for a dinner or something, and we were looking around at the house and how much light was coming into that room, and we're like, we could shoot the photo in here. And the idea for the photo was just a literal interpretation of in the story where they talk about the giant German shepherd named Garamond, because that's our shepherd and his name is Bodoni. So we thought, let's literally make a giant German shepherd. And let's just put it in Michael's house. And even hiding his little cat on the chair behind him, staring at the camera, looking afraid. Yeah, it was just a fun thing because that story is just kind of so odd.
Yes.
That by doing something as literal as making a giant German shepherd in a room, it just took on a surrealist quality.
And stacks of books, of course.
Well, and I think it also, it's our family portrait for the book. Since Bodoni's in it, you're in it, your cat's in it, it was kind of an ode to the three of us working together.
Well, you must have had a great time. And Michael, you're going to read a little bit for us.
I am.
Great.
You know, and I do want to mention also that the design on this, since it's so hard across the airwaves to see the visual, beyond being a book with illustrations, the design on this is a, sort of the third component that fits in. And to thank Bill Lavender from Lavender Inc.
It's published for publishing.
Yes. And this is the beginning of Port Saints, and it sets the table for what's to come. So this is also the beginning of the book, text-wise. I ducked into the bookshop on Orleans Avenue 2 days ago. Once a couple of steps inside, I stopped briefly at the moderately imposing but equally glorious wall of regional history books. Typically, I browse no further for the sake of potentially causing a disturbance, or only proceed by stepping around the right-hand side corner to the well-stocked foreign language novels. How to describe what I mean by disturbance? Let me best say that as with the ancient ziggurat temples and their honoring of gods, this shop, like many in the city, serves a similar role for the printed word. The comparison with the other worthy bookshops of New Orleans now ceases, but another takes its place. For as the spiral minarets followed from the ziggurats, more so books has its own unique counterpart. That the spirals are constructed of books rather than mud bricks does not lessen their visual impact, since they are precisely placed in spiral pattern as if to distinguish their erection from common vulgar stacking. These towering spine spires, whether perched atop uppermost shelves or ascending from the floor, abound from just past the regional books wall all the way through to the back of the store, any of them ready to defy careful maneuvering and transform a capable browser into an embarrassed fumbler and disturbance causer. As not to topple any of the beautiful spires, I limit processions through the shop as much as possible, aware of my size and the precariousness of the spiral minarets. On that muggy August day, though, I felt heat-buckled and peevish, ready to swing my weight around and send the spires spiraling. Sweat dripping from seemingly feverish pomp, I had a heart for disconnection, a mouthful of hurricanes, and an itchy trigger finger for churlish encounters. I was adequate for my task, or at least I was at first. Let me explain. It was rumored that the proprietor, a calm-voiced, gentlemanly son of an architect, was able to maintain quality titles on hand that appeared brand new, but for their prices, by a certain method, he took special orders. This is common, of course, but the rumor was that rather than using a proper distributor, he fulfilled these orders by way of sending quick-fingered thieves into other bookshops to retrieve and smuggle the requested titles back to him. I had not overheard any of these transactions, either front or back end, during my browsing over the years, though I was partial witness to furtive conversations and the occasional darting in and out by those who never browsed or gave the impression in any other way of being typical clientele, each time the proprietor calmly stating the same gentlemanly goodbye he imparted to me many times. Remember, like Faulkner said, nobody down here has time for reading because they're all too busy writing. To me, he often followed the quote with a wry grin and, "Until you return, sender." As strong as it was, the proprietor's literary and genial manner was not sufficient to mask further whispering of a back room that could be rented by the hour, and about the van always parked out front, supposedly stuffed full of sordid ephemera of all kinds for the late evening perusal of certain types who are predisposed to quicken in its presence. I know nothing of the renting of the rumored back room, but can solidly assert that the room exists, for I have been locked in it. I did not pay for it by the hour, but was locked inside due to a misunderstanding. Admittedly, one that might seem like a misunderstanding to an outsider, which is understandable, because for a flash it also did to me. But in fact, it was ultimately no misunderstanding, much less a sloppy error. Rather, a private understanding between me and the cosmos that regardless of the reason I was locked in this back room, an equally justifiable reason could easily take its place. This, I think, is neither an error nor a misunderstanding, but commonly called fate.
Ah, how atmospheric. I feel like I'm in that bookstore with you, and even when the stacks crumble, too. So what have you taken away from this work, from working together? How has it changed your thinking about what you do?
I told them I want to work with them on everything going forward.
I can see.
So we'll see how that works. But writing is so solitary that it was wonderful to work with people who have such energy and creative ideas. You know, you see a photograph, and essentially these stories might be thought of just descriptions of a photograph, but it's not that. And in their work, I guess what I tried to pull out, and which just working with them really helped, was rather than a static sense, more of like an inner dynamic quality. I think that's what they really brought forth.
So what about you two? What is it like for you to look and see your images bound up with someone else's words?
It's a great experience because most of the time we're showing photographs in a gallery. And there's different ways of showing those things in galleries when you curate. You know, you could rebuild narratives on how you place artwork, or like what goes next to each other, and what you leave out. In this, it was an idea of creating rhythm in the book. We didn't have to make an actual illustration of something that he describes in the story, because he already described something in the story. So we got to, kind of do something parallel. But then we also got to, play around with the rhythm of the physical book itself. There are, for instance, the persistence of wolves. I started drawing pictures of Bodoni and just placing him throughout the book. So he keeps popping up everywhere.
Right.
Even the dedication is the Canis Major constellation. And threw right. all that in there. And it's fun to be able to do that kind of stuff rather than just a single image to try to sum up a particular story.
Well, it's a very beautiful book, and I think people really will love seeing it. We've been talking with writer Michael Allen Zell and photographers Jeff Louvier and Vanessa Brown, creators of the Oblivion Atlas. You can meet them Wednesday, December 18th at 7 at McEwen's Books and Difficult Music on Chapultepec, and you can see images from the book on display at a gallery for fine photography. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Marty Mulet is one of Louisiana's best-known, most award-winning sports writers, known for his long tenure of more than 30 years at the Times-Picayune, as well as such books as The Game of My Life, The Sugar Bowl Classic, A History, Sugar Bowl, The First 50 Years, and Louisiana Athletes, The Top 20. Now he's back with a book that celebrates the highlights of most Louisiana sports and honors those who are to be found in the Louisiana Sports Hall of Fame Museum, which opened earlier this year in Natchitoches. The book is Game Changers, the Rousing Legacy of Louisiana Sports. Marty, buddy, welcome.
Susan, it's been a while.
It has. This book is so much fun. I love the stories, and the photos are just exquisite.
They really are. And of course, I don't really take credit for the photos, but I tell you, they're as much a part of it as the stories were.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great mix. This covers football, basketball, men's and women's, baseball, boxing, horse racing, golf, track and field, and of course there's a little lagniap. So since we're in football season, let's start there with some of the highlights. We're home to the first family of NFL quarterbacks.
True.
And then, of course, there's the 2006 Super Bowl.
Yes.
And were you there?
Yes. Of course.
So is that, you think, maybe the single greatest moment?
I would say the Saints Super Bowl in 2009 was the greatest moment.
Okay.
But I will tell you this. What I was hoping for was knowing that the book would be coming out about this time. I was hoping a year ago when the Super Bowl was in New Orleans that either the Saints would have been in it, that would have been a great story.
Oh, yeah.
Or one of the Manning brothers would have played in their hometown for the Super Bowl. Plus, at the time the season started last year, there were those who thought LSU had a chance to challenge for the national championship. If both of those things had come about, I would have known that I was up for canonizations.
Well, you know, I agree. The 2009 Super Bowl really was the best. And, you know, it's sort of like having someone ask me what my favorite book is. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
And then you go all the way back to the fourth Super Bowl, which was so interesting to me.
Yes. It was a game that altered the course of pro football. Plus, it had a certain lore for me because our friend Bob Rossler played such a role in it. And he really took a subservient role because the editor of the Times-Picayune took all the glory. But Bob did all the work. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be sure to point these things out.
Oh, sure. You're going to correct history when you write it, aren't
exactly.
you?
Exactly.
And then you have a lot of really interesting stuff about the Bayou Classic as well.
Mm-hmm.
Another really important event in our football thing. So tell us a little bit about Mel Ott. We're moving on to baseball now.
Well, Mel Ott was a seminal figure in baseball history. And, of course, it's almost impossible to think of this today, that a 16-year-old kid would be sitting on the bench of a major league park and learning the game at the knee of John McGraw, one of the great managers in baseball history. And he was not a big guy. He was about 5'10" and chunky. But he played in a park that was tailor-made for his hitting ability, and he ended up retiring after 22 years playing in the major leagues by hitting 511 home runs, which at the time only Babe Ruth and Jimmy Fox had ever hit more. So he was the National League leader in home runs for a long time. He was a great player. And, of course, he also has the distinction of being the guy that Leo DeRocher was talking about when he said he was managing the Giants, and DeRocher said, "Nice guys finish last." DeRocher was managing the Dodgers, and, of course, at the time, the Giants were not doing well.
And he grew up in Gretna.
He grew up in Gretna. Amazing.
Now, in basketball, you give great attention to that 1945 Loyola Wolfpack team.
Yes.
Tell us about them.
Well, because it was so sort of out of the blue. You never think much of Loyola as a
sports.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they've been out of sports for so long, and for one reason. But they had a team, and of all Orleanians who, you know, came, as I think someone said, there was a streetcar roster. They all came from Holy Cross, a Jesuit, and so forth. And they got into the NAIA tournament and beat a couple of notable teams. And all of a sudden, they're on center stage. They're playing for the national championship of NAIA. I'm positive when I say that it has to be the high point of Loyola athletic history.
And, you know, they've been sort of rescued, you know, from historical darkness. I mean, it's kind of they come into the light this year.
I say this when you bring them up. In one fashion or another, every four-year school in Louisiana is touched upon in this book.
Yeah.
Every four-year school.
It's really amazing. And, of course, in basketball, we're going to talk about Pistol Pete Maravich.
Yeah, well, you talk about a seminal figure. And I have to tell you, I say this all the time, I saw his first basket. And I think I'm safe in saying, because I saw him in college and I covered him with the Picayune, that other than his daddy and the sports information director at LSU and then later the Jazz, other than those two people, I think I saw more games of Pistol Pete than anybody else.
Oh, that's neat. Isn't that amazing when you look back and you've been
really
doing something for a long time?
And, you know, the thing is about Pete, when you see something enough times, it starts getting a little old. Mm-hmm. And it's only now, of course, I was blown away many times watching him. But it's like, yeah, I've seen that before and so forth. But now when I see clips of it, it's like my eyes widen all over. God, did I really see that? He was an amazing, amazing athlete. I don't know if he'd say this now, but at one time, Archie Manning told me Pete came out to Saints camp and was playing around with the guys and actually taking snaps and so forth and mm-hmm. doing stuff with the football. And Archie said he was the most amazing athlete he ever saw.
Wow, so that's a great compliment.
I think Archie's seen a few.
Yeah, I know. Now, two of the women in this book really appealed to me, and one of them was Edna Tiny Tarbutton of Baskin.
I have to tell you, my favorite chapter of them all.
Really?
It really is. It's simply because I didn't know about this. Uh-huh. And just by coincidence, a couple of months ago, I was in North Louisiana, and I passed by a sign saying Baskin High School, and we took a turn. And I just wanted to see where this, and like so many things, it's kind of a letdown. It was very small, unimposing. Now I think it's a special ed school. And the amazing thing is, as I love to say, the longest winning streak of anybody outside of the Harlem Globetrotters was Baskin, 218 in a row. But the amazing thing is, after that streak was snapped, they then won another 71 in a row.
Wow.
So we're talking about almost 301 mm-hmm. Would have been her. And, you know, she was apparently a stereotypical old school mom. her life was her girls and coaching them, and Brooke,
disrespect whatsoever.
Yeah,
she was tough.
That's right. But those girls, as you know, since you read it, they still love her to death.
I know. The name of that chapter is The Wind Beneath My Wings,
right,
which is really sort of sweet. What do you think of the name Tiny Tarbutton?
Yeah. I mean, you know. Yeah, and she was bigger than most men, though.
Yeah. Now, of all these sports, I have to ask you, which sport is your favorite?
You know, I have gone through this for 50 years.
Yeah.
I really love them all. Whichever one is in season is the one I think, you know, it doesn't get any better than this. Until the next one comes up. And then you go, this tops them all. So it's kind of whichever one's in season.
Well, a lot of people think being a sports writer is the happy life. Has it been that way for you?
Yes. And no, I mean, they think it's a happy life, but you know what? It's like what you do. It's hard work to do it mm-hmm. and, you know, to try and do it well. But it's very satisfying when you know you've pulled it off. It's very satisfying.
Well, the interesting thing about it to me is that it's such a mixture of skills. I mean, statistics are at the rock bottom of this, records and wanting to beat them. But the thing that makes you love someone is spiritual. It's that drive and ambition and never giving up and overcoming odds. I mean, it's just an odd mixture of things to put together.
It really is. And sometimes you wonder what drives people. You know, she's probably not that well known, but one of the intriguing moments was a woman, Queen Brumfield at Southeastern. They were the first women's team ever to win a national championship in basketball. And in the championship game against, I think it was Phillips College, she had to have her dislocated shoulder popped back into place 10 times during that game.
Whoa.
And she had a remarkable game. I mean, she led them in scoring and rebounding. And it was a moment you go, this is what defines a champion.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the best. Well, the essence of all sports is so often the great stories we bring home from the game or the meet, and you've brought them all home in Game Changers. We've been talking with Marty Mulay about his new book, Game Changers, The Rousing Legacy of Louisiana Sports. For more information, check out his website, LouisianaGameChangers.com. Thanks, Marty.
Thank you very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guests, Michael Allen Zell, Jeff Louvier, and Vanessa Brown, discuss and sign The Oblivion Atlas, Wednesday, December 18th at 7, at McEwen's Books and Difficult Music. John Besh signs Cooking from the Heart, My Favorite Lessons Learned Along the Way, Thursday, December 19th from 6 to 8 at Maple Street Bookshop. The Historic New Orleans Collection hosts a signing for Valerie Hart's House Proud, Unique Home Design, Louisiana, Saturday, December 21st from 2 to 4. Mary Fitzpatrick and Virginia McCollum sign New Orleans, Days and Nights in the Dreamy City, Saturday, December 21st at 2 at Octavia Books. Philip Collier signs Making New Orleans, Products Past and Present, Sunday, December 22nd at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Today's guest, Marty Mulay, signs Game Changers, The Rousing Legacy of Louisiana Sports, Sunday, December 22nd at 3 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Coming up December 30th through January 1st, the Hands-On Literary Festival, sponsored by Jennifer Stewart's Burlesque Press. The event takes place at the Maison St. Charles Hotel and features a host of writers, Joseph Boyden, Amanda Boyden, Moira Crone, Nancy Dixon, Lauren Grodstein, Roger Kamenetz, Bill Lavender, Dinty Moore, Cheryl St. Germain, and a host of others. I'll be there too. The festival will also host a New Year's Eve ball. For more information and registration, check out burlesquepressllc.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.